From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, US spy chiefs face Congress over uproar surrounding NSA spying tactics on America's European allies. We look at the Texas abortion law and why a judge ruled aspects unconstitutional. And with 100 days to go till Russia's Winter Olympics, we hear the latest controversies to grip the Games.
The project itself, the construction, is associated with big-time corruption, and the government barely even hides that.
And we take you to San Francisco, where there's an unusual solution to the ongoing housing crisis.
It's too expensive, and in reality, everywhere is too expensive. So my dad convinced me to buy a boat, sell it in a couple years when I don't want it anymore, and then I'll practically break even.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Senior U.S. spy chiefs have begun testifying on Capitol Hill amidst allegations the U.S. has been secretly eavesdropping on the leaders of its closest allies. The testimony from Intelligence Chiefs James Clapper and General Keith Alexander comes as pressure on the White House mounts to come clean about its electronic surveillance programs. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
In the spotlight and under pressure on Capitol Hill, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper and National Security Agency Chief General Keith Alexander mounting a robust defense of the country's surveillance operations. James Clapper told U.S. lawmakers in the House of Representatives that the intelligence community only works within the law. President Barack Obama faces stiff criticism over reports he was unaware of the extent of America's spying on the leaders of U.S. allies. White House spokesperson Jay Carney has confirmed there will be a major review. But there are denials, too, from the White House that any reassessment of its surveillance operations signals a policy climb down. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
In a 30-day progress report, the joint UN mission tasked with overseeing the destruction of Syria's chemical weapons says the country appears on track to meet internationally mandated deadlines. But safety concerns have kept inspectors from reaching two chemical sites. Our reporter at the United Nations, Stephen Fee, has more.
The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, has verified 21 of the 23 sites Syria declared last month. The joint UN-OPCW team says the international community's tight timeline for the destruction of Syria's toxic arms is still on track. Syria has until Friday to destroy its ability to produce chemical arms and until mid-2014 to rid itself of its entire stockpile.
One Obama administration official in charge of implementing the U.S. federal health care plan has officially apologized for the errors in the website preventing Americans from enrolling. The president's Affordable Care Act has been controversial since its announcement, but its issue-ridden rollout has only provided fuel for those who say the plan is a bad idea. Daniel Wrenches has more from Washington.
Marilyn Tavener, head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, gave members of Congress their first opportunity to probe the causes of the troubles with using the new healthcare.gov website, one of the gateways to the new insurance marketplaces under Obamacare.
To the millions of Americans who have attempted to use healthcare.gov to shop and enroll in healthcare coverage, I want to apologize to you that the website has not worked as well as it should.
Republicans insist the problems with the website are a first strong signal that government control of healthcare is a fundamentally flawed concept.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The Congolese M23 rebel group has defended its decision to withdraw from a key military base in Rumangabo. It follows heavy clashes with the DRC forces. Our Africa correspondent Isabel Nakira has the details.
Lawrence Kanyuka, M23 media attaché in Kampala, says the group pulled out to avoid civilian casualties, claiming there would have been casualties should the rebels have fought back. A DRC army spokesman says government forces have driven the rebels out of key bases and far from North Kivu's capital, Goma. The UN Security Council has condemned the fighting and called on both parties to return to the negotiation table. The M23 rebel movement claims their constant presence in Kampala indicates willingness to solve the conflict peacefully. Talks between the two sides collapsed after the DRC delegation pulled out following disagreements over an amnesty and integration of the rebels into government forces.
And Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron has unveiled plans for the UK to become the first non-Muslim country to issue an Islamic bond. By doing so, the government hopes to attract more Islamic investors. Mr. Cameron also announced a proposal for a new Islamic index on the London Stock Exchange. Our UK correspondent Natalie Powell reports.
Under Islamic rules, investors are forbidden from earning interest on business dealings, so Britain's Treasury is looking at how to issue bonds known as sukuk, which give a return on bonds based on profit from underlying assets, an alternative to interest. Prime Minister David Cameron has unveiled proposals for Britain to become the first Western government to issue these Islamic bonds, hoping to tap into the large supply of funds from Muslim investors. The Prime Minister believes these bonds would make London more attractive to investors, which would be an advantage for the UK's financial services industry. The UK is already the biggest centre for Islamic finance outside of the Islamic world, but Mr. Cameron would like to see it compete with those in the Muslim world.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Senior U.S. intelligence officials have been testifying before the House of Representatives after reports that security services have been spying on the communications of several European leaders. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper and National Security Agency head General Keith Alexander made the appearance after the Senate Intelligence Committee chair Dianne Feinstein, previously a staunch defender of the NSA, announced a major review of American surveillance operations. Our Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddick joined me in the studio earlier, and I began by asking her what the European delegation had been saying.
Well, first of all, Kevin, the very fact that this delegation is here, the US is saying, is part of an ongoing conversation, really, about security concerns. It's a delegation of nine members of the European Parliament. They belong to certain committees, including the Justice Committee, the Civil Liberties Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee. So quite a broad sweep there. And really, when this claim initially came out back in the summer, these claims of NSA surveillance, Europeans were pacified because they thought that they were told by the US that this was part of fighting terrorism, stopping attacks which do come all too often abroad rather than the US itself, so very much affecting Europe. But those claims have become much more suspect recently because of now new allegations that foreign leaders' phones, including, of course, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, her phone has been tapped. Once those surfaced, Europeans began to get ever more sceptical about American claims that this is all for their protection. And President Obama is really struggling to contain the anger now about this these anti-terror or so-called anti-terror data sharing programs. One of the German delegation has said this is a question of limits. How can we target only terrorists and not everyone, including allied leaders? And Claude Marais, he's a British member of the European Parliament, also part of this delegation, has said this isn't just cosmetic. It's not a cosmetic situation. He also talked about being given, when he was here on Monday here in Washington, stock answers by the Americans along the lines of, well, spying just happens. You have to get used to it. It's part of what countries do to each other. And he said that's just not going to wash. Now, the delegation has been working with Mike Rogers, who's the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee. And he has been largely supportive of NSA spying programs. But he says he's going to lead a US delegation to Brussels to continue this dialogue. And in the meantime, he wants to rewrite wrong perceptions that he thinks the Europeans may have about any alleged NSA spying, as well as re-establish trust. But crucially, he and other American security officials still won't confirm or deny those reports of spying on Angela Merkel and other European leaders.
And what might they be pushing for in terms of an agreement with Washington?
Well, the delegation has said that, first of all, the Civil Liberties Committee of the European Parliament are going to be looking for possible legal remedies resulting from that alleged surveillance on European citizens, though it's not clear exactly what that might entail. And we haven't heard much more about that so far. But one member of the delegation, as I mentioned, Claude Marais, he's been speaking with members of Congress and said that he has genuine concerns. They're getting tired, as I said, of those excuses that spying has always existed, even between friends. So one thing that he and particularly German members of the delegation may be pushing for is what's known as a non-spying pact. That is a formal agreement not to spy on each other. And this is something that the US already has with what's known as the Five Eyes. That includes other English-speaking countries like New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Britain, and of course the US itself. They are the Five Eyes. They have, and the US does have this non-spying agreement with those countries. Germany wants to be part of that as well. France does too. But for years, Germany in particular has been told no by the State Department and the security officials here. If we give that to you, then we'll have to agree that non-spying pact with just about everyone, including France. And the US has been in the past particularly concerned about France because of the extent of its alleged industrial espionage here in the US.
FSN's Lorna Shaddock there. Now, for the first time ever, survivors of drone strikes came to Washington today to testify before Congress about the impact the lethal technology has had on their families and their communities. Pakistani schoolteacher Rafiq Ur Rahman told a House briefing, which only five members of Congress attended, that the strike that killed his mother and wounded his children last year has stirred anti-American anger in the region and called for the practice to end. The event came on the heels of several major investigations by the United Nations and independent human rights groups that found that the drone strikes have killed hundreds of civilians in several countries and may constitute war crimes. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has more.
On Tuesday morning, Florida Democrat Alan Grayson invited the Raymond family to Capitol Hill to testify about the drone strike that targeted their family almost exactly a year ago. Grayson, who called the targeted killing drone program extrajudicial and wrong, fought back tears as he welcomed Rafiq Ur Rahman and his children, Zubair and Nabila.
I thank each of you for your willingness to be here, your bravery, and your ability to share your stories that need to be heard. I wish that we didn't have to meet due to the loss of someone you love, and I know the trip here to America has been hard for you. Thank you for being here with us.
Grayson was just one of five members of Congress, out of 535, to show up at the briefing. The Raymond family traveled from their home in North Waziristan, a tribal area heavily targeted by U.S. drones. Last October, the family matriarch, 67-year-old Mamana Bibi, was killed by a strike, and her grandchildren Nabila and Zubair were injured. The children's father, Rafiq, told the gathered reporters and lawmakers Tuesday, with the help of a translator, that he came to Washington to set the record straight about his mother's death.
Nobody has ever told me why my mother was targeted that day. Some media outlets reported that the attack was on a car, but there is no road alongside my mother's house. Others reported the attack was on a house, but the missiles hit a nearby field, not a house. All of them reported that 3, 4, 5 militants were killed. But only one person was killed that day, Mamana Bibi, a grandmother, a midwife, who is preparing to celebrate the Islamic holiday of Eid. Not a militant, but my mother.
Raymond, a primary school teacher, said he's had to go into debt and sell some of his land to pay his children's medical bills. He has received no acknowledgement or assistance from either the U.S. or Pakistani governments. His translator began crying as she interpreted his plea for answers and justice.
Congressman Grayson, as a teacher, my job is to educate. But how do I teach something like this? How do I explain what I myself do not understand? How can I, in good faith, reassure the children that the drone will not come back and kill them too, if I do not understand why it killed my mother and injured my children?
Both Grayson and the other lawmakers at the briefing vowed to work to reform and rein in the targeted killing program, increasing oversight and transparency, and compensating any civilian victims around the world.
I think that our use of drone killing and over-reliance on drone killing is a dangerous and wrong step in our national defense.
That's New Jersey Democrat Rush Holt, who said he left the briefing deeply moved by the family's story.
This family presented such a compelling image of what it means to rain death from the sky, unseen from a blue sky. A grandmother teaching her grandchildren how to recognize the ripe vegetables in the garden. She was not plotting against the United States. She was not working against American national interest. And even if she were, to have some intelligence operative or even group of intelligence operative serve as judge, jury, and executioner for someone is just contrary to the American sense of justice.
The pressure is mounting on the Obama administration to disclose its legal justification for carrying out the strikes in countries where the U.S. has not declared war and where the U.N. Security Council has not authorized the use of deadly force. New reports by the United Nations, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch found a high number of civilians killed in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, and said the practice could be considered a war crime. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
A federal judge has thrown out parts of a new Texas abortion law, judging the legislation unconstitutional. Opponents of the proposed law said it would force a third of the state's abortion clinics to close and deny women access to the procedure. Supporters of the original bill argued that the law protects women and the life of the fetus by improving health care. Earlier, I spoke to Jessica Farrar, a United States politician and an incumbent in the Texas House of Representatives, about the significance of the ruling.
Probably the worst part of the entire legislative packet was this hospital visitation privilege requirement that said that physicians performing abortions had to have hospital visitation privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of where the abortion was performed. The problem with that is that hospitals, as the Texas Hospital Association testified in committee, they were opposed to the legislation because they said that they typically don't grant hospital visitation privileges to doctors that don't perform procedures in their hospitals. And then we also have the issue of religious hospitals, and other hospitals might have a stigma about letting an abortion provider have visitation privileges there. So it was a good thing that this was done, and the judge said that there was no rational reason for doing this, and so this was that was a great triumph for us.
What do you make of the argument from supporters of the bill that the law would protect women and the life of the fetus by improving healthcare?
When the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists comes out opposed to the legislation, it should tell you that the motive for the legislation were not in the best interest of women's health. And the best way, I mean, I understand what they're trying to do, and I would walk with them if they would walk with me, in the sense that to reduce the number of abortions, a huge step to reducing that is providing men and women both access to birth control methods and education about birth control methods. But to put a woman's health in danger, it serves no one any good. There are ways to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish without endangering women's lives, and that's what the concern is here. Anyway, I think that again we have politicians making medical decisions, and that is not the right thing to do. The state of Texas has required doctors to give women false information, for instance, that there's a link between abortions and breast cancer, which the American Cancer Society has come out against. But nonetheless, that is state-issued propaganda that doctors have to give to patients, and they the state of Texas has interfered in that one and in other ways in the doctor-patient relationship.
Incumbent in the Texas House of Representatives, Jessica Farrar. Now, as the fighting continues in Syria, the country is facing another pressing problem. The World Health Organization has confirmed an outbreak of polio, a disease which has largely vanished from Syria. The UN agency announced the news as an emergency immunization program got underway to try and reach hundreds of thousands of children who are now at risk. Nick Harper reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
Polio had all but disappeared from Syria, with no reported outbreaks since 1999, almost 15 years. Oliver Rosenbauer from the UN agency, the World Health Organization, confirmed the news.
Initially, there were 22 AFP cases that were being investigated as part of this cluster, and out of 10 of those cases, they've isolated wild poliovirus type 1.
On top of the 10 confirmed cases, Rosenbauer said another 12 people are undergoing further tests.
A lot is still unknown, and investigations are still ongoing. They all appear to be very young, so less than aged 2, and they all appear to be under or unimmunized.
And that's the big problem. 2.5 years of conflict have meant immunization programs have broken down or disbanded, giving limited access to vaccinations. Before Syria's civil war began in 2011, 95% of children were vaccinated against polio. But the UN now estimates 500,000 children have not been immunised. Marixi Mercado from UNICEF says the war has put Syrians, especially the very young, at greater risk of disease.
The conflict in Syria has caused immense displacement, with millions of children on the move, either inside the country or across borders into neighbouring countries and beyond. As a result, routine immunization systems, so critical to preventing childhood diseases, have been disrupted or broken down. Children are now at far higher risk of diseases such as polio and measles.
Some 5 million people have fled their homes as a result of the fighting. This level of movement and the fact that refugees end up in camps, often living in squalid conditions, is of real concern to the WHO, as Rosenbauer explains.
So this is a communicable disease, and with population movements, it can travel. It can travel to other areas, and so the risk is high of spread across the region, of course.
It's also not clear how the disease managed to resurface in a country where it had been largely eradicated. One theory is fighters from other countries entering Syria to join the war brought the disease with them. An emergency immunization program has now got underway. The UN agencies, the WHO and UNICEF hope to vaccinate 2.4 million children for polio, measles, mumps and rubella. But the lack of vaccines is just one of many problems faced by the people of Syria. A recent UN report shows malnutrition is on the rise, as are chronic illnesses such as cancer and diabetes, the lack of access to treatment exacerbating the situation. The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, presented the findings in New York.
This is a race against time. Words, despite their ability to shock, cannot really paint a picture of the grim and gruesome reality of Syria today.
A reality where hundreds of thousands of people, especially young children, are now at a far higher risk of contracting diseases and dying than they were before the conflict began. Nick Harper, New York.
As the days count down to the Sochi 2014 Winter Olympics, serious questions are being asked of the project. Russia has spent over $30 billion on construction so far, with accusations of bribery rife. Gay rights campaigners also say more pressure should be exerted on Russia in the build-up to the Games over the country's recent clampdown on so-called homosexual propaganda. Tom Barton reports from Moscow.
100 days until Sochi 2014. One of Vladimir Putin's pet projects, this Winter Olympics was supposed to be a showcase to the world of Russian efficiency. Instead, it's mired in delays and corruption, says Masha Lipman from Moscow's Carnegie Center.
Sochi, I think, in the minds of many in Russia, the project itself, the construction, is associated with big-time corruption. And the government barely even hides that. The eventual cost, I don't think we even know it yet, but it's going to be exorbitant. And most importantly, is not the sum itself. It's just how much has been spent or squandered on this construction or stolen.
The stadium for the opening ceremony still isn't finished. And part of the project's eye-watering budget is already double that of London's Summer Olympics, and that's just for construction costs. A garish countdown clock near Red Square is one of hundreds of such installations across Russia. They gloss over the furore surrounding the millions of dollars that seem to have disappeared from the budget and the mess the half-finished building boom in Sochi has created. And that's not even mentioning the storm around gay rights in the Olympics. Russia's ban on so-called gay propaganda has led to calls for a boycott of Sochi and gay rights protests there. On a visit to the site, Vladimir Putin was keen to try and allay fears that gay athletes could be arrested or beaten up as they arrive.
We are doing everything, both the organisers and our athletes and fans, so that participants and guests feel comfortable in Sochi, regardless of nationality, race or sexual orientation.
Putin has, over the years, both applauded the project and publicly berated managers about levels of corruption even he can't ignore. Now he's trying to defend the winter white reputation of Sochi, being increasingly blackened in the run-up to his great spectacle. Tom Barton, Moscow.
San Francisco's sky-high property prices have forced residents to look for alternatives to conventional apartment living. Rent increases are among the highest in the country and vacancy rates are at 1-2%, making finding somewhere to live a highly competitive game. For that reason, some young professionals are opting out of the bidding war and discovering creative solutions to the city's housing crisis as the authorities rush to boost the stock of affordable homes. Rebecca Bowring reports from San Francisco.
23-year-old Genevieve Angle lives on water. A receptionist at a fertility clinic in San Francisco, she makes the short commute across the bay from this marina in Alameda. That's where she set up home aboard a 32-foot powerboat. It has a kitchen, toilet, two bedrooms, even central heating. Genevieve loves living here, but it's a lifestyle choice she made for financial reasons.
I wanted to live in San Francisco, but it's too expensive, and in reality, everywhere is too expensive. So my dad convinced me to buy a boat, sell it in a couple of years when I don't want it anymore, and then I'll practically break even.
Genevieve owns her boat outright and says the monthly cost of living savings are huge.
I pay about $400 for the slip fees and for my water and utilities. I figure if I was living in a one-bedroom place in San Francisco, I'm not going to get it in a decent part of town for less than $1,500.
In some San Francisco neighborhoods, the cost of renting an apartment has doubled over the last year. Plenty of young professionals earn a respectable wage, but they're increasingly choosing to opt out of paying large sums to landlords. Blogger Tynan lives in an RV or mobile home. In a city where parking is a daily nightmare, he's afraid of being evicted from his spot.
If you park in a really nice neighborhood and people see your RV and they see that you're kind of flouting convention, you're not paying for rent in this place where they're paying a lot of money, they do get upset and so they'll call the police.
An influx of tech workers has ramped up pressure on San Francisco's housing stock. Sarah Karlinski, deputy director of the urban planning think tank Spur, says lower and middle class residents are being priced out.
As these millionaires and multimillionaires come to the city, it can be just enormously disruptive to the fabric because people end up having to go.
During the recession, San Francisco barely built any new homes. Now there are belatedly about 6,000 units under construction, and the city's become a leader in the provision of affordable housing.
With every new unit of market rate housing that's constructed, developers need to either pay a fee to construct affordable housing or they need to build below market rate units within their buildings themselves.
So far, demand for this kind of low-income housing is far outstripping supply. But San Francisco city leaders hope that in time they can close the housing affordability gap before too many long-standing residents are forced to move away. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can get in touch with us by emailing reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Wednesday, why British artist Banksy has New Yorkers divided. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.